oftentimes you just need a little bit of information to make thoughtful decisions, and that can be transformative. So I can get about 80% capacity in terms of knowledge on a particular topic. And then staff are great. They know more than anything else. So then they could get me to the 100%. But oftentimes I just need to get to 50, 60% just to be in the room, to be thoughtful, to be able to ask those other questions. So I effectively was able to know everything about everything because I had ChatGPT up, and I would tee that up with, you know, my teammates in the room as well.
Hi, I'm Boaz, founder and CEO of Simply Augmented, and I'm excited that you're tuning in to Shift AI, a show that explores what it takes to thrive and adapt to the changing workplace in the digital age of remote work and AI. In today's episode, I'm thrilled to have Senator Joe Wynn as our guest. Joe currently represents the 34th District in the Washington State Senate and is leading the charge on crafting meaningful AI policy and exploring innovative ways to use AI in his daily work. If you're someone interested in the way that AI is shaping public policy, you're not going to want to miss this episode. We are honored to have Joe on our podcast, and we can't wait to learn more from him. Let's get to it. Joe, thank you for coming on the Shift AI podcast. I am super, super excited to talk to you today about AI and politics. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me. I've listened to your podcast, so there's a tremendous guest list that you've had, so I'm honored to be included.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're going to have fun today. We're going to talk about some cool stuff. But before we get going, you have an amazing origin story, and you know, I want you to talk a little bit about how your family came to the United States. You ended up studying at Seattle University, student body president. You went out into the business world, UBS, Expedia, Microsoft. I mean, you're now our state senator from the great state of Washington. You are the chair, and I want to make sure I get this right, the Environment, Energy, and Technology Committee. You're the vice chair of the Ways and Means. And you sit on human services. You have a huge impact in the state. But what's exciting about the show today is that you're probably one of the state senators that knows the most about technology. And I think, you know, you're geeking out on AI like I am. And so I'm excited to talk to you about this stuff today. I want to make sure I get all of the job descriptions right. But correct me on the job descriptions and then tell a little bit about the story of your family coming here from Vietnam.
Yeah, no, I think that's all right. Folks don't know that our state is actually a part-time legislature. So I actually do other stuff on the side as well. So I worked at Microsoft previously, consulted for a little bit. I run a national Asian advocacy organization called the AAPI Victory Fund now as well, in addition to being a state senator. But my background professionally largely has been in the tech space. So it's an honor to serve, but it's interesting to see kind of that juxtaposition from the business tech community into the legislature, and we'll talk about that in a little bit.
And then how about your family? I mean, it's you spent most of your early years in Seattle, but your family's from Vietnam, and the story of how they got here is just amazing.
Yeah, so, you know, I have a picture on my wall in my office in Olympia of the boat my family used to escape Vietnam. So my father fought in the South Vietnamese Navy alongside the US Navy, and he evac'd out with everybody else in the 70s. So for 3 years, my mother and my older sister didn't know if he was alive or dead, because there was no email, you can't make a cell phone call, there's no apps to use to reach somebody. So for 3 years, they had no clue if he was alive or if he was dead or if he was in the United States. So long story short, he finally is able to send messages to Japan, and then Japan to Vietnam, and they lived in a fishing village, and stories are coming out about how people are escaping on boats. So they got on a boat in the middle of the night, tried to escape. First time, they got caught. All the men had to jump off the boat, because if you're a guy and you're trying to escape Vietnam, it does not end well. And you know, they go back. They do it again in a year, finally make it. And they end up, you know, you can call it sailing. They drift basically for 2.5 weeks off to the coast of Japan, ran out of food, ran out of water. Thankfully, the U.S. Coast Guard, which was patrolling the water at that time, found them, took a picture. A Japanese fishing vessel picked them up. They were able to be in Japan before they met my father in Seattle, where me and my siblings were born. And that's kind of the origin story. There's a lot more going on to that, but the reason why that's such an important story for me is that oftentimes we'll get messages from people that say, hey, isn't this hard? You know, constituents say, isn't being a legislator hard? Isn't your work hard? And the answer is, you know, certainly it is hard. But then I look at that photo and I'm like, that was a lot harder. So I'm just honored to be here.
And, you know, when you were growing up, it doesn't sound like politics was on the table. I mean, it wasn't something you guys talked about at the dinner table, but your dad was a pretty prominent person in the Vietnamese community. What was the conversation like? What was the vibe at home like? And how did that impact you as you got into the business world?
Yeah, I think, you know, my background lends itself to service. So my father was one of the founding Vietnamese members in the Catholic Church here in the United States, in Seattle specifically, and he helped physically build the church that's here. That was kind of the cultural epicenter for the Vietnamese community. So he was an elder. My mom was an elder as well, just based off of the hierarchy in their family. But what really had an impact on me was his accident. So my father was in a car accident when I was 7 years old or 6 years old. I was actually the one that found him in his accident and left him quadriplegic, left him brain damaged. And that obviously took a toll on our family as well. And one of my most vivid memories growing up was actually when my brother and I, we would have to carry him up and down the front steps of our house because he was in a wheelchair, we didn't have a ramp. So to go to his appointments, we'd carry him up and down the front steps of our house. And our neighbor drives by one day and says, hey, I saw you carrying your dad. Why don't you guys build a ramp? You know, obviously the answer is we couldn't afford a ramp. We were too poor. The next weekend, he comes by with his buddies and they built a ramp for us that we then used for, you know, the 13 years that he was able to live beyond that time. So service to community has always been a part of my life, because if not for the people that helped raise me, I don't think that I would be here, right? And I get a chance to serve the district in the community where I was born and raised and where I grew up. So this is not just an elected position. This is not just a legislative district. Like, I don't think that I would serve anywhere else except for in this district, just because these people literally picked me and my family up in our time of need. And now I feel obligated to do that and give back to the community as well.
You live in such a diverse district. Will you describe to the audience the territory that this district is? Because it's got such amazing industrial parts of it. It's got a very, very vibrant community that is Black, Brown, and otherwise. Talk a little bit about where this district is.
Yeah, so I get to serve in the 34th Legislative District. So West Seattle, White Center, parts of Burien, Vashon, Maury Island. I have a quarter of downtown Seattle. I have half of the waterfront, Pioneer Square, Soto, South Park, Georgetown. If you've gone to a Seahawks game or a Mariners game, you're in the district. Most of the commerce in Washington State goes through our ports. That's in the district. So I have robust industry. I have, obviously, historic parts of, you know, Washington State and Pioneer Square. I have great communities like White Center. I have a rural island, you know, in Vashon. So you have to balance the needs and perspectives of all these different communities in order to effectively serve them. So it's I think that diversity in geography certainly helps me stay on my toes. And I think that helps me become a better legislator as well.
I'm excited to talk to you about the different things that you're doing right now in the state legislature. Our mutual friend, former Senator David Frocht, introduced us. And when I first heard about you, for all the folks out there that are geeking out about AI, I heard about you in the context of the facial recognition legislation. Yeah. But you're doing a lot more on the technology committee, and you're thinking a lot, very deeply about the way that AI and other technologies affecting constituents. But can you describe the facial recognition work that was done and how that played out through the Senate?
Yeah, I mean, that was probably the most contentious bill I've ever done. And I learned so much throughout that process, because there's a difference between policy and politics. That's the foremost thing that you have to understand. And when I first came into legislature, one of the best pieces of advice that I received was that the legislature fundamentally is set up to solve yesterday's problems tomorrow. It's inherently slow. The folks who are there aren't campaigning because they want to have good technology policy. They did other things. So when we worked on the facial recognition policy, it was part of a broader data privacy bill, which is kind of ironic because the Washington Privacy Act under Senator Carlisle and myself helped draft it, hasn't passed in Washington State, but it's passed basically in most other states in the United States at this point. So it's kind of the irony is that the bill lives on in other forms. But the core component of it was also facial recognition. And obviously there's a lot of concern around bias, a lot of concern around how it can be used improperly, how it can be used for surveillance. But, you know, at the end of the day, when you unlock your phone with your face, that's facial recognition. It's widespread. When you unlock your computer, it's facial recognition. So that process was interesting because you pitted consumer advocates with technology and you had to walk this really fine line, which, you know, I was able to do in a very contentious way. There's a lot of maneuvering that had to happen. I think the biggest takeaway that I had from that was I had to explain to my members, I had to explain to legislators who are governing today why language, for instance, there was an amendment that said, I want to ban facial recognition in public spaces. And, you know, the idea was they wanted to prevent surveillance. But I just said, hey, if you write that language that way, it's illegal for you to have your cell phone. Right. And they're like, no, that's not true. That's not true. And I'm like, it took me 30 minutes to explain how if you ban facial recognition in public spaces, your iPhone is now illegal to have. We can't do that. Right. And we saw that in a lot of policies across the United States where they said, we're banning the use of facial recognition in the public sector. Well, all of our computers unlock with our face. All of our phones unlock with our face. So I made a flip comment and I said, hey, if you do this, you're going to ban all our computers. No, we're not. Right. So it was this kind of pushback where I found that the policy, drafting the policy, wasn't actually that hard. You know, we were able to figure out a path that made sense that I think everybody was happy with. Explaining to people the need for thoughtful policy that wasn't going to ban technology on accident was actually the core crux. And when you get emotion involved, it becomes a different ballgame. That's kind of the gist behind the facial recognition bill.
How do you think the state of Washington, in relation to some of these privacy / facial recognition and AI, you know, there's so much regulation happening now in AI, especially with the executive order that Biden put into place. How do you think about the state of Washington? How do we shape up relative to New York, California, and some of these states that are first?
Well, you know what's interesting? I'll give you two answers. First one is we're the home of two of the largest tech companies in the world, right? So we should be leading the conversation on some of these things. And the other thing, so I've been a legislator for 5 years at this point, and what I've noticed is that there's really only four functioning state governments in all of the United States. And when I say that, I mean they have either part-time or full-time staff. They meet on a regular basis, and they have some level of funding for their legislature. Most state governments are either volunteer, they meet every other year, and they're completely understaffed, meaning the members themselves don't have somebody writing policy for them. So what happens is that these four states oftentimes will pass policy, and then you'll see copycat legislation that happens throughout, which is what you saw with the Washington Privacy Act. I think it's implemented in 13 or 14 states at this point. So in terms of Washington's ability to lead on this, it's so important because oftentimes what we do is nation leading, and then it becomes kind of the law in other places. So we have to get it right, or else you're going to see things not go well in other parts of the country and then potentially at the federal level as well. We're lucky that we have the resources in Washington State to have thoughtful policy. My analyst, the person who drafted the policy, she just moved on to a different role, but we were so fortunate to have her. It was funny, she was studying for a privacy certification, and she had to review legislation that's passed in the country to get this certification. And the irony was she was reviewing legislation that she wrote. So in order to pass a privacy certification for her role, she had to review privacy laws that were existing now that she wrote, including the facial recognition bill and some other things as well. So Washington has always been a leader when it comes to Boeing, to e-commerce, to, you know, technology with Microsoft, Amazon, everything else as well. And we certainly should be at the forefront when it comes to AI because we have that ecosystem here already.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's interesting about your background is that you worked at Microsoft, you understand technology. I know you've admitted to me like, hey, you know, I'm not a coding, you know, technologist, but, you know, when it comes to the legislature currently,
yeah,
my sense is that you are leading the way in terms of a technological understanding. And I think I'm excited, and you and I have talked about this, about doing some things where we can educate other politicians in the state. And I think that's really exciting. As you think about the next two or three years and the kinds of legislation that's going to come up? What are some of the things that are on your mind from a regulation standpoint? What are some of the things that are bringing you energy?
Yeah, I think especially when it comes to technology, you know, I say it a little bit facetiously, but candidly, one of the reasons why I've been given the opportunity to serve in certain capacities is because during the pandemic, you know, the one eye man is the king in the land of the blind, right? So I was the only one that knew how to use the computer, and I was helping members use their computers, figure out how to do a virtual setting. And because of that, I was allowed to be in all of the rooms. I was in all of the rooms, virtual or in person, and be able to kind of have an influence in that space. And thankfully, my colleagues agreed, and now I get to be chair and be vice chair in charge of the budgets. And the thing that excites me the most is how much positive impact you can have in a given space. So sometimes as a legislator, you forget how much of an impact your work has. We were at lunch, right? And a person recognized me and said, you know, thank you for your service. Like, you're such a part of the community. We appreciate it. You forget how much of an impact that you can have on everyday life, but also, you know, on the grander scheme of things as well. Whenever I travel, legislators go on these trips and conferences, and they'll say Washington State. They'll say, oh, there's this privacy bill. There's this bill. And it's like, oh, I wrote that bill. It's kind of funny that it becomes kind of a manifestation elsewhere. So on the AI front, I think similar in terms of what we did for facial recognition, the goal is not to ban the technology. The goal is to ensure that we have guardrails in place that we can thoughtfully innovate so that we can use this technology for good and make human quality life better, right? It's not that different from fire. We need fire to have heat, to have warmth, to cook food. Fire can be bad. It can burn things down as well. So you have to be smart about how it's deployed, how it's utilized. And what's interesting is I met with staff at the U.S. Commerce Committee. So they're the ones that are in charge of AI. And we talked through what potentially that can look like as well. So I do think that there's going to be policy in place that will be thoughtful. I think it's going to be hard to pass at the federal level for a number of reasons. And we'll likely have to lead in the state a little bit. But right now, what I'm excited about is how do we deploy this in a way that's thoughtful, that we can make people's lives better, that we can have better services as a form of government, and that we can actually, you know, save people time and less stress.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I think is incredible is a story that you told to me recently about the way that you use AI personally, currently, yeah, in the work that you do. And it, I guess I shouldn't be surprised because I know how powerful it is. But given the role that you have, I was just blown away by how effective it is. You know, one of the things I know about your work is that you're on two committees. They're like full-time jobs. You're the chair of one that's a full-time job, and you're vice chair, yeah, of another. It's basically, and I love, yeah, the way that you're using AI to give yourself superpowers. Can you describe to the audience a little bit about that?
Yeah. So my background is not in the public sector. I didn't have an electoral background. I didn't work in politics and government. So when I came in, I kind of came in with a mindset of technology first, just because my background at that time was at Microsoft. So if you go to my office, it looks like a tech break room. We have snacks, we have drinks, we have an espresso machine. It's, you know, mid-century modern. And the reason why I bring that up is to give you a sense of the contrast. So when I came into office, there were stories written about my office, the physical office, the interior design, because most senators' offices, old wood mahogany desks, heavy drapes, you feel like you're, you know, in this like grandeur, right? Mine was the, yeah, exact opposite. It was basically a tech room. I gave my staff the senator's office, which is this big room overlooking the Capitol. I take the small kind of closet office where I just do my thing, which is unheard of. So this blew people's minds. And what really blew people's minds was the fact that I was using Calendly to schedule meetings. Most of the staff time is spent coordinating schedules and doing meetings. Well, I felt that if I was going to hire a bright, brilliant person, I'd rather them helping me with policy and talking to constituents. And that just was a big no-no. People pushed back. They said it wasn't allowed. I just did it anyways. And it became this kind of contentious thing, but now it's normal.
Yeah.
So that's the context in which I exist. And that's not even AI, that's just your calendar. So you fast forward a little bit, you know, ChatGPT has been out for a year and a half. And last year, I was fortunate enough to be one of the chief budget writers in the state. Usually there's only two in the Senate, and they added me as a third, kind of as a succession plan. They knew that I wanted to be in that space. They wanted to be in that space to learn and grow. And we had just rolled out ChatGPT, you know, as a society, nobody in the legislature really was using it. And to give you an idea of how the budget process works, literally, right, there's two people, at least in the Senate, and there's about eight people in the House, and we have to debate effectively a 1,300, 1,400 page document, hundreds of different topics. You're talking everything from human services to timber management to technology to healthcare. Think of any potential topic that can come up that costs money. We have to debate how much that's going to cost, where it's going to go, what you do. So it is physically impossible for anybody to know all of it. And the way that it works is the House is on one side, the Senate is on the other side, and all of our staff members, there's about 40, 50 of them, sit in the room as well. And then if a question comes up, you ask them. And staff are amazing and they're fantastic. So I'm not going to take anything away from them. But as the new person coming into this, coming in blind, I didn't want to look as if I didn't know what I was doing. So I would have ChatGPT up. I would have the document that we're using to debate, and it's just one line. So you have a spreadsheet, one line, and then a number, which is what you're debating. So there's no way to get enough context in order to be thoughtful. So I'd go through that list. I'd look at all the things that I didn't know enough about, and I would have ChatGPT structure my arguments. How long have Washington State been doing this? Is there any data to suggest that this is successful? What other states are doing it? What are ways to improve this thing? So I would go down this list of things where the way that it works is it's the Senate position or the House position. So basically you're debating, I want to do the Senate thing or I want to do the House thing. And sometimes it can be contentious, as you can imagine. So I would make the list of all these things. I would have all these arguments laid out. I would have data from other states about what's going on. And then you would go down. So you go down this list. Most of the times it's not contentious. The moment there was something that came up that I cared about because it was a Senate position, that there was some concern, well, I would say, well, actually, we've been doing this for about 10 years. We spend about this much money. This is the outcome. Five other states do this, and data suggests this is the right way to go. Done. Debate's over. We win. We win every single time. And you know, candidly, this is the first time the budget in Washington State has been bipartisan, which is rare. We didn't raise any new taxes. It was balanced across a four-year budget, and then we had over a 10% reserve. And then we invested in things like behavioral health and special education to make sure that, you know, we felt good about it. And I think oftentimes you just need a little bit of information to make thoughtful decisions, and that could be transformative. So use that tool to get me to about 80%. So I can get about 80% capacity in terms of knowledge on a particular topic. And then staff are great. They know more than anything else. So then they could get me to the 100%. But oftentimes, I just need to get to 50, 60% just to be in the room, to be thoughtful, to be able to ask those other questions. So I effectively was able to know everything about everything because I had ChatGPT up, and I would tee that up with, you know, my teammates in the room as well.
That's amazing. I mean, it really, it makes me feel good to hear you say that, because we at Simply Augmented, we talk a lot about getting to the 80% and then having humans come in and augment that experience. And that's exactly what you're doing. And now, before we dive deeper, I want to take a quick moment and tell you a little bit about one of our podcast partners. As a listener of this show, I know you're trying to stay on top of all things AI and tech, which is why you have to check out the amazing GeekWire podcast, produced by GeekWire and hosted by Todd Bishop. It's a treasure of insights featuring industry leaders and the latest tech trends that are shaping our world, and the perfect companion podcast to Shift AI. GeekWire Podcast is where technology meets curiosity and covers the world of technology, startups, and geek culture. Expand your tech horizons and join the conversation. Tune into the GeekWire Podcast today, a perfect complement to our own discussions here. Don't miss out. Follow the GeekWire Podcast on Apple Podcast, Spotify, or your favorite listening app. Now back to the episode. I've read before that you've been involved in negotiations with other senators on certain issues. Are you also using AI in situations where you're being kind of vaulted into a negotiation that you're kind of unclear about?
Yeah. So here, I'll give you two examples. Last year, again, there were a number of senators who were very passionate about forestry management. First off, if you want to go down a rabbit hole, forestry management at Washington State is a topic that I did not know was so important, but also so contentious at the same time. It was $83 million line item. So we wanted to spend, or
wow,
the chair of Ways and Means at that time wanted to spend $83 million to protect the forest. Obviously, there was another senator who didn't agree because he represents areas that include timber industries. So there was this huge battle that we had within our caucus. And our majority leader said, "Win, go negotiate a deal. You got 3 days." So I go, I sit down. I have 0% knowledge. Forestry, the only thing I knew about forestry management was where I could go hiking with my kids. I had no clue what it was at all. So I'm sitting in this room with the chair of Ways and Means, with the senator from the timber community, and then they were able to pick one expert. So one expert to protect trees, one expert for the timber industry, and then me. So I was the least knowledgeable person in this entire room, locked in a room. And as we were kind of going, my job was to find that path, find that common ground for us to actually make progress. And, you know, they're throwing out terms like silviculture, you know, how long can you sequester carbon for that CO2 to actually make sense? What's the turnover? Like all these different things. So during this time, I would just talk to ChatGPT, kind of have it figure out basic, talking points that I would need, things that I would have to consider. If there's something that I couldn't get from ChatGPT, I would ask my staff who was there as well. And I learned so much from that experience. And long story short, what ended up happening was we were able to pass a bill in a budget that both sides wanted. That was thoughtful. You may have seen that our current DNR commissioner, Hillary Franz, just purchased 2,000 acres of land to protect and sequester carbon. That money is from that negotiation that we had in that room. And the other one that's really fascinating too is, in the legislature, we get reports all the time. And I actually like to read reports. Like I will spend my evenings reading the newest Economic Forecast Council. There's a group called JLARC. They do all the reporting for Washington State. It's always interesting nuggets. But there are 50 to 100 pages and they're very, very dense. And there's no way you can physically go through all of them. So with ChatGPT, you can upload documents. You could have it scan the documents, summarize it. I'll ask it questions. And then, you know, I'll get basically 80% of the context of that document within a minute, literally a minute, when normally it would take you probably 2 hours to read. So I will just crush reports. Anytime there's a forecast that comes out, I have it summarized. I know what's going on. Yeah. And then what I found too, you actually told me about this, where you can build your own kind of localized chat where now what I do is I upload all the documents related to that particular topic, and then I upload the report. So that way you have that additional context. Before it was only for that particular thing. So, you know, I've been lucky enough to be placed in a role where I'm in charge of a major committee and in charge of the budget. And candidly, I think if not for the timing of ChatGPT, probably wouldn't be the case. Because the only reason why I even have this baseline knowledge of the things that I'm doing is because ChatGPT, OpenAI helped me get to a point where I'm competent enough to even be able to engage with my staff who then get me to the rest of the way. So, you know, I do think that there's a very productive role in government for the work that's being done at AI right now.
Yeah, I hear that through the grapevine, there's some other Senate staff members that are hearing about some of the stuff that you're doing and asking for technology advice, which I think is pretty funny and amazing.
Yeah, it's on Facebook. So I'm saying this publicly because it's on Facebook, it's public. Drew Hansen, Senator Drew Hansen from Bainbridge, posted on Facebook saying, "People don't realize how many reports we have to read as members in order to stay current on our topics." So I text him. I took a screenshot, text him, said, "Hey, I just use ChatGPT and this is how I do it." So it's in the Facebook post. And he's not really quite sure what that means. So he calls me, I show him how to do it, and he's using ChatGPT 3, not 4. So it's a little bit different. And I show him how to do it, summarize a report, and it just blows his mind. Funny thing is the first thing that he used for it when he was testing was to create a Taylor Swift playlist, which I didn't suggest he did it himself, but it's a fantastic way to get your knowledge base up in a very short period of time.
So these are all amazing kind of positive stories, but there's a lot of people out there that are afraid. They're afraid of the technology. They're afraid of losing their jobs. There's risks that I know, you know, you as a senator have to think about. So let's talk a little bit about that. Some of the things that are top of mind, either things that have been discussed in chamber or just things that you're thinking about. Talk a little bit about that.
We had a really productive committee hearing a couple of weeks ago where it was focused on AI and the use of AI in society as a whole. Everything from the security risk associated with potentially using that data for bad things, like weapons or for other things, and the impacts it could potentially have on labor as well. So the funny thing is, my committee had an AI committee hearing, labor and commerce had an AI and a workforce hearing, and that even early education had an AI hearing around what that looks like. So obviously there's a lot of energy behind it right now, but it is technology and it is susceptible to hallucinations, and it's data at the end of the day. So if you have data that is biased, if you have data that is wrong, and you're feeding the model doesn't decipher morality per se, it's just based off of programming. So you have to make sure that the information that's being used is one that is safe, is one that is appropriate, and the outcomes are more kind of what I'm focused on. So in my mind, when it comes to regulation for safeguards as it relates to AI, it's the outcomes that you want to address. So if there's high risk categories, whether it's in law enforcement, surveillance, financial matters, interviews, where there's a potential human impact if something goes wrong, I think that there should be a certain level of review, right? I think the technology itself should help augment the work that we're doing in the name of your company. But because of that, you also have to be mindful that nothing is perfect. And also, perfect means different things to different people. And for us as a society, we have to have this social contract and say, hey, what is off limits? What should we be able to do, but also with some review, because you don't want to have automated bias kind of going widespread. We had a great conversation in our committee. Microsoft was really leading the way, Salesforce leading the way. Workday is now getting involved in this as well. And trying to find that balance is very, very hard, because most folks, when they look at technology policy and there's something that's scary, two things usually happen. One, you ban it, or the other, nothing. Nothing happens because nobody knows what to do. And I think AI is one of those things where it moves so fast, you cannot necessarily regulate the technology, because there's no way that the legislature or any governing body can regulate the technology fast enough. But there's also potential positive impacts that we're seeing that we just talked about as well. So when it comes to the risk associated with it, it has to be balanced with the rewards. And I think really being mindful of who could be most impacted. I'm working on a potential piece of legislation right now with our attorney general around a task force, including multiple players in this space who can help govern and help kind of talk through what that could look like, because I think that's the key, is the technology is one component, but really it's how does it impact people, and you have to surface that up. And that is something that you can't necessarily do with AI, but you need to have those kind of thoughtful conversations so that folks who are impacted are a part of that conversation.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to think about it. I have another question that's kind of a two-part Washington question. One is DC, yeah. And the other one is, you know, is our state. So my question is, what did you think of Biden's executive order, just generally? I know that yeah. You were just invited to the White House, you know, for a holiday gathering, and you're involved, you know, in another group that is connected to the White House. How are you thinking about things at a federal level? And then I also yeah. want to talk about Seattle. You know, you and I discussed Seattle as a hub, as an AI hub. There's a lot of potential around this, given all the things that are happening in our state. So yeah, first, maybe just discuss a little bit about the Biden administration and AI regulation, how you're seeing that play out.
Yeah, no, I thought it was interesting where he did bring together a group of experts in that space, and I think focused more on kind of the fear aspect associated with it. Obviously, he recognized that there's a huge potential and a need for some of the regulations in that space, kind of put his marker out there. It was probably more heavy-handed than I would have expected for an executive order. But at the same time, you know, it's something that is so important, so drastic. He wanted to be able to show leadership in that space. When I spoke to some of the staff members on it, part of when you look at policy versus politics, at least on technology side, it's usually if something goes wrong, how do you handle enforcement? So that was kind of one of the key points that I've spoken with his team and some of the staff members on is, candidly, it goes from either a Consumer Protection Act, so AG enforcement, or private right of action, where you could hire a lawyer to go and sue. What I found is, at least on technology policy, including AI, 80% of it is pretty non-controversial. Tech companies will agree. Consumer advocates will agree. It's usually the 10 to 15% that's along the enforcement and the penalties that people don't necessarily agree on. So that's where I think that conversation will likely probably happen. What I would like to see also in parallel is as we're providing these frameworks to regulate a technology that does have broad implications, is also how do you foster innovation and growth in a thoughtful way? So I'm a parent, you're a parent, I have three kids. You know, all the new rules that we see in the blogs right now is that you reinforce good behavior. You reinforce good behavior. Don't just use the heavy hand, reinforce good behavior. And for us at Washington State, that's where we have a chance to lead. To the second point of your question, we have the Allen Institute for AI. We have UW, we have Wazoo. We have these great technology hubs kind of here. And how do we ensure that the technology being deployed is done in a thoughtful way, is done in a way that's commensurate with our values? And part of that is a public-private partnership, in my mind, is how do you have these innovation clusters? How do you support research? Part of the reason why AI is becoming a thing now is compute power. Compute power is at a level where it's never been before, but what that also means is there's energy consumption associated with it. So in order to process AI models, it's incredibly energy intensive, incredibly expensive. You know, how do we ensure that's done with clean energy? How do we help subsidize potentially some of the cost so that way folks like the Allen Institute can have their own models so that you can potentially check for bias as well? So one of the things that they had proposed at the federal level in the EO was a certification. I don't think a certification necessarily works at a state level. It would have to be done at more federal level. So that's kind of an interesting concept, but essentially what that means is we want to make sure that, you know, we understand that it's being used for good, right? So that's going to be kind of a complicated task. So things that we can do in Washington State is help offset some of the costs for research, allow for innovation and growth when it comes to, you know, physical spaces, providing, equipment if needed as well. And this is not new. This is what we did when Microsoft was founded in South Lake Union with Amazon, with clean energy. So there are ways for us to engage as a public sector to encourage positive growth, which is kind of where I want us to go.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. I'm really passionate about making Seattle a place that is thought of as an AI tech hub. And I think that we'll talk more about it because I think it's really, really powerful. And we're very, very lined up to make that happen, given all the entities that we have here. So I think that's exciting. Shifting gears, I want to hear a little bit about the impacts of individuals on your life. I know your mother is a big influence on you and the journey that she's gone through. Talk a little bit about your mentors and, you know, from along your journey that led to, you know, where you are now as a state senator.
Yeah, no, this is a good one. I think obviously my mom being the main one. So as folks heard, my father was in a car accident. So I grew up in basically a single parent household where, you know, my mom was working, you know, 80 hours a week. My sister had to help raise us, tremendous amount of influence. I think the first mentor that I had that kind of broke me out of that cycle in terms of that poverty cycle was a guy named Craig Allen. Actually, he was a youth pastor of mine. Met him when I was in middle school, and he was the first one that kind of showed me where, you know, I grew up in a certain type of community that you see certain types of things. I didn't know that the outdoor existed. I didn't know that there were these job prospects that were available to me. I didn't know that higher education was, you know, a thing that not only did I need to do, but I also can thrive in as well. And I think he was instrumental kind of in that space. And I was very fortunate that I had a couple of teachers that also were forward thinking and were able to help me out. Ms. Dominguez in middle school, Ms. Gutierrez in elementary school, Mr. Green in elementary school as well. So I can see specific points in my life where I had a tremendous amount of influence just to show that there was more potential than I had out there as well. And I will throw in Governor Gary Locke. I remember I was in college, I was student body president. I was giving a tour to Phyllis Campbell, who was one of the trustees at that time at Sandy University, VP at JP Morgan. I think at that time, I think she's retired now. And she made a kind of the off the cuff comment and saying, hey, you should really meet Gary. I'm a college student. I'm, you know, whatever, 20 years old at this time. And, you know, Gary who? Oh, Governor Locke. You should meet Governor Locke. I'm like, well, that's not really a thing that happens for me where I just meet Governor Locke. Lo and behold, she sends me an email the next day, connects us, we get coffee, and we had a great chat. So we've connected, you know, ever since then. And really just seeing his leadership and seeing his success has been kind of instrumental in my life. And that's been one of the most impactful people that I've met I will throw in on the technology side, the reason why I got so curious about that is my brother-in-law, you know, was early on computer science, studied computer science, computer engineering. So when he married my sister, we would always have computers at our house. We were one of the first homes to have a computer, and therefore I was able to use that in a way that nobody else even knew how to do it. So I've always had that background in computer engineering, computer science, and I think that's part of what got me to where I am today.
So I always ask this question at the end of the show. If you were to describe the future of work, the future of AI and emerging technology in two words, and then you can elaborate, but what would those two words be?
Basic income. If you look at the trajectory of technology and you look at the output for our GDP as it relates to the human population, especially in the United States, we've seen greater growth historically than we ever have before. And the idea that automation and the idea that AI could potentially impact our jobs is a very real thing. And I do think that if you're a creative, for instance, and you're very high level at your job, you're very good at it, you're probably safe. But as folks that are trying to figure out how to get into that and are kind of not as good might have a harder time as well. So I see that the divide in income, the divide in digital equity is going to get worse, where folks who can't use technology are going to do really well, and those who cannot use technology are not going to do very well. And we see that already manifesting in terms of how wealth is concentrated and how society is treating, you know, very systemic things. So the reason why basic income is important is I don't think that it's going to replace your income as a whole, but there needs to be a kind of a baseline in which we're able to give services to folks. So that way, you know, they're not going to be struggling to get housing, to get food, to get a job, things like that, where they're able to actually elevate some of their skills and learn and grow while this technology is kind of changing as well. So this is a much broader implication as it relates to our society, but basic income is kind of what I would think about when it comes to the future of work.
Well, Joe, I really appreciate you coming on. I'm really glad that we have a state senator that is thinking about these issues, you know, basic income, AI, using ChatGPT on the ground in the legislature, all of these things. I really feel like there's a ton of opportunity, and you know that I'm passionate about this, but I'm really happy to hear that there's politicians in the state that are paying attention. So thank you so much for coming on the Shift AI podcast. I really appreciate it. We might have to follow up after the legislative session and do another one of these.
Now that sounds fantastic. Thank you for having me.
That's a wrap. Thanks for tuning in. Such a pleasure to have Joe as our guest on today's episode. Joe's knowledge and experience in the state legislature and his willingness to pursue emerging technology and dive into AI policy is unique among state politicians. If you want to learn more about Joe, you can find him on LinkedIn and Instagram. If you're interested in how he thinks about AI policy, definitely connect with him and keep up with his posts and activities online. I continue to be amazed by the guests we've had on the show, and I'm excited about the ones joining us in the near future. I truly appreciate you spending your time with us. Thank you for listening to this episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Shift AI podcast for more exciting interviews, and to the Simply AI weekly newsletter for updates on how AI can help you scale your business. The Shift AI podcast is produced and sponsored by Simply Augmented,